Now, having heard it through all things, the next aim is to experience it directly and fully, without the intermediary things. And so we move now from the fourth chakra to the fifth, which is here at the level of the throat. Now, this is called Vishuddha, V-I-S-U-D-D-H-A, Vishuddha. The S will have a little accent, acute accent over it. That word means purgation. This is the level of purgatory, purging away the interfering gross experience and coming directly to the pristine, pure image of God and sound of Om. It is the realm of spiritual exercises, the exercises of the yogi. And as you can see, what we're doing here is turning the energy of the third chakra, the aggressive chakra, against ourselves, purging out the interferences, the laziness, and so forth, that keeps us away from the divine beatific vision. And then at the point between the eyes, which is called Ajna, A-J-N-A, both A's being long A's, which means command, the center of command, the soul, the energy, beholds in full radiance the beatific vision. That is to say, the vision that I spoke of when the water stands still, the form of forms beheld. Now, the Indian word for this is Lord, Ishvara. And any god can be taken as this Lord. The image that you have held in your mind as the image of God is what will there be experienced. Be it Yahweh, Shiva, Vishnu, or the goddess, be it Christ, or the Trinity, or the highest image of the Buddha, any will be all right. And what beholds it is called the jiva, the living entity, that jiva which has gone through many incarnations and is the soul of your own existence. Here, the subject beholds its proper object. At this level, the erotic principle of the second chakra finds its goal, the true beloved, the beloved that our soul intends is God. And anything short of that is simply an inkling of what the experience of God would be. Now says Ramakrishna, speaking of this, we're only at the sixth chakra and we're in heaven now. Well, what more do you want, we might ask. This level beholds, however, an image that has characteristics, qualities. This can't be the whole thing. Furthermore, we are separate from it. We have not experienced identity with it. And so, there comes the effort for the final realization. Now, in this kind of thinking, heaven is the last and final temptation. The Yoga Sutra says, when the sage has reached this level, beholding the divine and the divine landscape of the heavens with the holy sages and saints and all, if he thinks so much as, I have made it, I am here, this is my bliss, he goes right down the scale again because ego has been enforced. Ramakrishna says that the experience is as though you were to see a light through a pane of glass. It's the agony of the moth that's trying to reach the flame and only bangs against the glass. He wants to reach the flame and become the flame and burn away his separate entity by union with the flame. And that's the goal of the mystic. And so you withdraw the pane of glass and both are gone. There is no God. There is no one to behold it. There is no subject. There is no object. We are in the realm of that silence. This is the ultimate goal of all Oriental intention. Now we come to a very strange mystery. What is it that happens as you pass from Ajna, the center of command, where the serpent power reaches the highest level within the realm of manifestation, and what is called the thousand-petaled lotus of the crown of the head, Sahasrara, that means thousand. S-A-H-A-S-R-A-R-A. What can we say of this strange thing that happens between here and here? So that here there's nothing. You cannot say a thing either is or is not. The things are no things, there's nothing there. And here, where, below which all things are dual. This line is the mystery of Maya, M-A-Y-A. The word Maya is from a root ma, M-A. These A's are long A's, which means to measure forth, to build forth. Maya is what builds forth the world. Maya is said to have three powers. The first power is called the obscuring power. It obscures the radiance of the ultimate. The second power is called the projecting power. It projects the world of broken forms. The third power is said to be the revealing power. That is the power rendered in art, when through the forms we experience the radiance. Now these are exactly the same things can be experienced either in their obscuring or in their revealing aspect. When you are studying things in the spirit of the first three chakras, the obscuring power is working. But when in art the radiance is experienced, and the fascination of the art object is that of discovering your own true radiance there, because there's only one radiance, and that's the radiance of full consciousness, then you have the awakening and the opening of the lead, so to say, to full realization. These images, these themes, are translated into mythological images. The upper, ultimate light may be depicted as the father. Then this line, Maya, becomes the mother, through whom the energy of the father becomes incarnate. That's the imagery, for instance, of God the Father, Mary, and God the Son, and the Holy Ghost representing the actual energy that is transformed from father to son through the Virgin. That is the role played by the Indian goddess Kali. She, in her role of projecting power, is the one who projects all forms into being. But she, in her role as the revealing power, is rendered in the form of a horrendous destroyer, because she destroys the self-existence of things and unites them to their source. She is depicted with one hand in the do not be afraid posture, another in the boon bestowing posture, another holding a sword, another holding a head that she has just taken off. And she has a kilt of arms and legs and a necklace of 72 bleeding heads. And her great red tongue is out to lick up the world that to which she has given birth. And she is black as night, because she is that mother void out of which all things come and back into which it goes. And it was to her, primarily, that the great holocausts of animal and human sacrifice were offered in the great period of India's religious life. Or, this mystery may be depicted as the god Shiva, particularly in his dancing form as Nataraja. He is shown with one hand holding a little drum. It's a little hourglass-shaped drum. That drum going tick, 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 tick is the veil of time, which shuts out the dimension of eternity. Eternity is not a long time. Eternity has nothing to do with time. Time thinking is that which shuts out the eternity dimension. So when you think, shall I be alive after death? You are thinking in temporal terms. That is the kind of thinking that belongs to the moon symbols. But when you realize that eternity is right here now, and that the possibility of your experience is to experience the eternity of your own truth and being here now, so that that which you are was never born and will never die, then you are thinking and experiencing in terms of the solar mystery, the solar light. So this little hourglass shuts us away from eternity by bringing about the creation of the world of time and ourselves within it. This left hand of the god holds a flame, which is the flame of illumination, the solar flame, which burns away the veil of time. This is the hand of creation. This is the hand of destruction. This is the hand of bringing you into a sphere of illusion. This is the hand of opening your consciousness. Another right hand says, don't be afraid. And then the other left hand is in what's called the elephant posture or the teaching posture. Where the elephant has gone through the jungle, all animals can follow. Where the great teacher has gone, all the disciples can follow. So what does that hand do? It points to the left foot, which is lifted, and that foot means release. Whereas the right foot is down on the back of a little dwarf whose name is ignorance. The right foot drives us all into this realm of ignorance. The left releases. Creation, destruction, don't be afraid, because though there is incarnation in ignorance, there is release. The head is perfectly still. This is called the drop, the bindu, that point through which eternity breaks. The right ear has a man's earring, the left a woman's. This is the sphere where the pairs of opposites come forth. In the hair is a skull, meaning death, and there is a moon, meaning rebirth. And there is also a little female form. It represents the river Ganges, which carries the grace of the heavenly knowledge and experience into the world of being. And the whole figure is surrounded by a great aureole of flame. This is the dancing god that fills the entire universe and dances in every atom and in every cell of your body. And you are that Shiva. That's the ultimate statement, Shiva Hung. I am that Shiva. So now we've reached the top. And now I want to speak about a little more about the symbology here. I've spoken of it in Hindu terms. I want now to speak about it in Buddhist terms. The great text, and if you can get hold of it, do. It's in paperback, is the Tibetan Book of the Dead, as translated by Evans Wentz. There's a very fine introduction, a multiple introduction, one by Evans Wentz, one by Sir John Woodruff, who's one of the greatest English explainers of the tantric systems, the systems that I'm talking about here. And there's a commentary also by Jung, who points out the relationship of all these symbols to our Western psychology. It's a marvelous, rich, very wonderful book. Now, this book tells about the 49 days that elapse between death and rebirth. The goal, however, is not to be reborn. So that if you can stop the descent to rebirth, well and good. Beside you, as you lie dying, will be your chaplain, the Lama, who has been your spiritual guide. And he will tell you where you are on this mythological journey into the realm beyond the realms of waking and dream consciousness. Beyond waking, it's really mostly dream consciousness that you're in. The notion is that at the moment of death, you behold the light, the void of the light, the radiance of the light. If you are not ready, however, you can't hold to it. It is so terrifying because you want to hold to your own personality, and it blasts you. So the Lama will be saying, when your last breath is breathed, you are now before the light, try to hold to it. I've taught you how to do it, now go to work, hang on. If you have read Aldous Huxley's Time Must Have a Stop, it's based on this book. A man dies, and instead of holding to the bright light, he remembers the lovely body of his mistress, and that brings him down pretty fast. This is the experience of the seventh chakra at the top. Now, if you fail here, you come down to the level of the sixth chakra, the level of the radiant, beneficent aspects of the divine. And in the Buddhist system, these will be represented as Buddhas. Buddhas of various amplitude. The first is called Vajracchana. It's a Buddha holding the thunderbolt, which symbolizes illumination. And then we come down the scale to the Buddha of the East, of the South, of the West, and of the North. And then to all five of these Buddhas together in the form of a great circle with Vajracchana in the center. The Buddha of the East is called Vajratara, the one who supports the thunderbolt. And he represents the integrity of the illuminating experience. The Buddha of the South is called Padmasambhava, Ratnasambhava, the one born of a jewel. And he represents the radiance of beauty of illumination. And the Buddha of the West is Amitabha, the Buddha of inexhaustible radiance. And he is the great Buddha of love and compassion. And the Buddha then of the North is called Amoghasiddhi, and he represents the Buddha of directed effort. Each of these has a color associated with them: white in the East, yellow in the South, red in the West, green in the North. And if you still haven't been able to release yourself from the fall, you come to the stage then of the fifth chakra Buddhas. And these are horrendous. Now, when you see the Buddhist tankas, those Buddhist long pictures from Tibet, you'll see many horrendous-looking figures with great swords and terrifying faces, often with many faces, often standing on great monsters and holding many weapons in their many hands and embracing their consorts, because the male and female principles always work together here. There's no notion of God or anything like that as being exclusively male, as we have in our somewhat patriarchally prejudiced tradition. Here, the two principles work together. And these horrendous figures are the ones who are smashing our hold on ourselves. The beneficent ones would have released us if we could have let go. Now, we haven't let go, so now comes real force. But the thing to realize is that these horrendous ones are the same as the beneficent ones, only in the more brutal aspect, because we have been brutal in holding on to ourselves. And again, we get the five in the regular series going on down. And this level, now here's an interesting point, they represent vices. The vice of egoism. The vice of pride. But the vice of pride is simply the negative aspect of the virtue of beauty. The vice of lust, which is the negative aspect of the virtue of compassion. The vice of jealousy, which is simply the negative aspect of the virtue of directed intention or effort. And so, by carrying through our vices, we can achieve redemption. And the Lama will say, remember, these are simply forms of your own mind consciousness. Then we come, and here is the crisis, we're getting pretty dangerously close to rebirth now. We come to the fourth chakra, and this is the chakra of judgment. You remember, this is where the devotee touched the feet of God, now he may lose the feet. Here's where we stand on our campus, between the realms of contemplation and the realms of what is now being advertised as activism. The whole thing will be lost if you respond to what are called the karmic winds. These blowing breaths that cry, kill, kill. There is something to be gained. There is something to be lost. You have to hold to the thought, nothing to hold, nothing to gain, nothing to do. If you lose that, there will build up behind you a wall of three powers, and then you cannot go back. And the three powers are stupidity, malice or anger, and desire or lust. Those are what move the world, and we're moving down now. At this point, the Lord of Judgment appears in the form of a great ox with many hands. This is a figure you see all through the Tibetan tradition. And his minions will come, and you will find yourself carved to pieces, your guts torn out, all the tortures you can possibly think of, and the Orient has quite a little glossary of tortures, will be enacted upon you. And you have to think, these are simply manifestations of my own thought. If you can't think that, you start for the finale. At this point, Freudian psychology appears. Namely, the soul in the descent begins to see males and females copulating. And at the third chakra level, the Lama is saying, try not to get between them. And if that is lost, then comes this very interesting experience of delight in what's about to happen. And what you find is, if you are to be born now as a male, you will love your mother, find yourself loving your mother and hating your father. Did Freud teach us anything? And if you are going to be born as a female, you will find yourself hating your potential mother and loving your father. And then, after all this, having gone for 49 days through all the planes, from the supreme consciousness down to this, this little squealing thing is born and thinks it has come new into the world, but within it is the whole thing again. This is the Oriental concept now that underlies the cults that we see. This is the aim, to find that in yourself. Now, there are two responses. Suppose you have found the light and have contemplated this still pond. You may let the body drop off. Close the eyes, as it were, and unite with this central transcendent realization. Or you may open the eyes and take delight in the play of forms, seeing through them the one form. That is the attitude of world affirmation, and it includes the affirmation of every single thing, even the monsters. When I was in India, I listened around a while to see who the wise man would be that I would choose to have my principal sort of mystical discussion with. And I chose one who had lived in the world. He had been a policeman, which is not regarded very highly in India. And he was, nevertheless, a great saint. And I was introduced to him and went into the room where he was sitting, and there was a chair for me to sit in, and we greeted each other respectfully, and he asked, do you have a question? And I had the good fortune to ask him the question, which he had asked his guru when he first came to him. And so we had a fine conversation. And what I said was, what I asked him was, if, as we know, all things are Brahman, are this divine energy, then why do we renounce the world? Why do we renounce vice? Why do we renounce stupidity? Why do we not see the divine shining through the most brutal, the most horrendous, the most stupid, the darkness? And he said, for you and me, that's where it is. Now, to conclude, let me just tell a little Indian anecdote. They're awfully good anecdotes. This has to do with animals. It has to do with a tigress who was, some of you may know this story, who was starving, very hungry, and she was pregnant, on the point of bringing forth her little one. And she comes upon a herd of goats and pounces very strenuously on the herd and brings about the birth of the little one and her own death. The goats scatter, and when they come back, what do they find? They find a just-born little goat, a little tiger, and its dead mother. Now, they have very strong parental instincts, these animals, and they adopt the tiger, which grows up thinking it's a goat. It learns to eat grass. It learns to bleat. And as you can imagine, since neither grass nor bleating are proper to tigers, it was a pretty miserable specimen of its kind by the time it reached adolescence. And just at this critical moment of passing a threshold, the herd is pounced upon by a great male tiger. And all the goats scatter, but this little thing's no goat. This is a tiger, and he's standing there. And the big one looks and he says, "For heaven's sake, you're living here with goats?" And the little thing goes, "Meh." And he nibbles a bit of grass. The big fellow is utterly mortified, wallops him a couple of times, and finally picks him up by the neck and takes him to a pond. Perfectly still, no wind. The little fellow looks in, and for the first time in his little long life, what he sees is his own true face. It's not a goat face. It's a tiger face. And the big fellow, the guru, says, "Look, you've got a pot face like mine. You're a tiger. You're not a goat." Well, the little thing bleats a few more pitiful times, and at last, the big one, thinking he's really getting somewhere with him, takes him again by the nape of the neck to his cave, where he has recently killed a gazelle, the bloody remains of which are all over the place. And so he picks up a chunk of this delectable goody, and he says to the little fella, "Here, have a chunk." The little one backs away. He says, "I'm a vegetarian." So with his mouth forced open, he has this stuff shoved down his throat, and he gags on it. And the text says, as all do on true doctrine. So with that, and this new experience going through his veins, he feels a new heat, a new life. And automatically, spontaneously, his own tiger nature awakened, he gives a tiger stretch, and out of his little throat comes a sort of preliminary tiger roar. Tiger roar A921. And the big fella says, "There we are. Now let us go into the forest and eat tiger food." Now I like this story and I tell it to my students, and the answer I get is, "Put a tiger in your tank." So this is what the story tells. We are all tigers living among these goats. So go into the forest, and in the, you know, the forest of the night, find the tiger shining bright in your own deep depth.
You've been listening to Imagery of Rebirth Yoga, the fourth talk by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the work of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH, 1-800-330-MYTH, or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughan. Thank you for listening.